oh, to live on Sugar Mountain with the barkers and the colored balloons. You can't be 20 on Sugar Mountain, though you're thinking that you're leaving there too soon. You're leaving there too soon.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Lustig, who is a pediatric endocrinologist who has spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He is the director of the Weight Assessment for Teens and Child Health Program at the University of California, San Francisco's Benioff Children's Hospital, a member of UCSF's Institute for Health Policy Studies, and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book just out is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Robert Lustig.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And your lecture some time back on sugar as a toxin got an enormous amount of attention. We were grateful that we were able to offer it up in our fund drive when it came out a few years back, and it got several million hits on YouTube.
Blows me away.
It does, but you know, on the other hand, we learned, for example, that the heads of the world's largest processed food companies, Coca-Cola and Nabisco, they all met at Pillsbury headquarters back in 1999, mm-hmm. and they were told, they were given a briefing saying that their food is the reason for the epidemic of obesity in this country, and right. they clearly decided not to deal with it.
Hunkered down, you know. They basically know what's going on. Whether they knew the science of it or not is not clear, but they certainly knew what was going on. The article in Mother Jones from December of 2012, written by Gary Taubes and Kristen Cousins, chronicles the history of exactly what the food industry knew and when they knew it. And to be honest with you, it's very close to what happened with tobacco. And I guess that shouldn't be too surprising, because after all, what do you think the tobacco companies diversified into?
Exactly. Well, this is a business that makes $1 trillion a year in sales.
Makes the tobacco industry look like a dwarf.
But at a social cost approaching what, $300-400 billion in.
Well, just yesterday, CNN reported that diabetes costs America $245 billion a year, and that's just diabetes. Never mind the heart disease. Never mind the lipid problems and stroke. Never mind the cancer and dementia.
So it strikes me as being extraordinary that you and others have isolated the cause, the central, or at least the main driver in this country's becoming less and less healthy, and yet it can't be stopped. It can be identified, but not stopped.
Well, here's the deal, Ian, in 10 words or less, it can be stopped, but the food industry obviously doesn't want it stopped, and to be honest with you, the federal government is in bed with the food industry, and there's reasons, obviously, you know, promotion of business. The fact is that 6% of our exports are food. So what would happen if all of a sudden our federal government came out and said, you know, all that sugar that we've been adding to all the food and all the fiber we've been taking out of all the food over all these years, you know, really isn't so healthy for you. What do you think would happen? What happened when that one downer cow went from Canada to Washington State back in 2006? It wasn't even our cow. That was the end of meat sales to Britain and South Korea for 2 years. Bottom line, government's job is to protect the food supply, and that includes protecting it from me and from us, you know, the people who are trying to do something in terms of public health. Ultimately, public health spends dollars. You know, industries makes dollars. The government's job is to help industry do it. This is actually a war between us and them. And I know which side I come down on. I'm a physician. I'm a pediatrician. I take care of obese kids. I watch their lives absolutely go down the tubes. I I feel for these kids, and I need to help, you know, use the science to make things better.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. And he's the author of the new book just out, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And not only, of course, are we consuming more sugar than ever, we're eating 33 pounds of cheese, which is triple what we ate in 1970, 70 pounds of sugar, which is 22.
We're eating way more than that of sugar. That's a way low guesstimate. We are more closer to 120 pounds. We were used to be up as high as 142 pounds. We have cut back a little bit because we have switched to diet drinks to some extent. 42% of all soft drinks sold in America now are of the diet variety. So that has cut down on the sugar somewhat. But we are still way over our limit. We guesstimate, and this is just a guess, that we can probably process about 150 to 200 calories a day in added sugar. We are currently at 450 calories a day. So we are over 2.5 times over our limit.
So let's, if you would, explain to the layperson here, Dr. Robert Lustig, about what happens to the sugar, and particularly the high fructose corn syrup, and that is ubiquitous in food,
right,
and how it's metabolized in the liver and then converted into liver fat, and that apparently is. That's where the rubber meets the road in obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, isn't it?
Well, we think so. Basically, your listeners need to understand that we're first of all talking about added sugar. We're talking about sucrose or table sugar, the white stuff, the stuff you put in your coffee, and we're talking about high fructose corn syrup, the stuff that basically the corn refiners, you know, turn corn into. We're not talking about milk. We're not talking about the sugar in fruit, that's whole fruit. We're being very specific. We are talking about agave, maple syrup, and honey, but they contribute very minor quantities altogether. So we're talking about added sugar. Added sugar is made up of one molecule of glucose. Glucose is the energy of life. Every cell in every organism on the planet runs on glucose. Glucose is so important that if you don't eat it, your body makes it. That's how important it is. And then there's this other molecule called fructose. Fructose is the sweet part of sugar. Glucose is not very interesting. Fructose is way interesting. Fructose is the reason why we seek sugar. Fructose is the whole reason behind why sugar is added to processed foods, because the food industry knows when they add it, you buy more. So what is so special about fructose? Well, from a metabolic standpoint, three things. First, when you overdose your liver on fructose, it has no choice but to turn that fructose into liver fat. And that's a way of exporting it out of the liver, except for one thing. It gets caught. It gets caught in the liver, ends up causing fatty liver, causes insulin resistance, and causes all those downstream diseases that we've just talked about, especially diabetes. And we have now actually published a paper last week, got a lot of press, that shows that sugar directly is involved in the production of diabetes, irrespective of its calories and irrespective of its effects on obesity. Sugar is toxic. That's what we've shown. Number two, sugar binds to proteins, and when it does, it causes the browning reaction. So this is why bananas brown and apples, after you've cut into them, brown, etc. The browning reaction causes cell damage. And it also releases little hydrogen peroxides, which damage the cell and can ultimately cause cell aging and ultimately cell death. Fructose does it 7 times faster than glucose. So you can imagine that if you're consuming a lot of sugar, you're getting a lot of cell damage, and that ultimately translates into disease. And then finally, the third way that sugar, and fructose in particular, is a problem is because your brain thinks you haven't eaten it. It doesn't register, and so you actually get hungrier, and so you end up consuming more. And it happens basically because it works on the hunger center to make you think you want more, and it works on the reward center to make you think you need more. And the bottom line is you end up consuming more, and that is exactly why the food industry has put it in everything. Of the 600,000 items in the American food supply, 80% of them are spiked with added sugar. And that's not because we asked for it. That's because they put it there.
And what are the restraints on them? What are the incentives? Purely the same incentive that a drug dealer has to their clients?
Is it just... Of course. Absolutely. Same reason that tobacco was so successful until, you know, it wasn't. The bottom line is we have an area of our brain called the reward center, and it needs reward. And there are different ways it can get reward, but drugs of abuse are one way it gets reward. So tobacco, alcohol, street drugs, cocaine, amphetamine, name it, heroin, you name it. But the bottom line is sugar does exactly the same thing through the same mechanisms, through the same receptors, with the same neurotransmitters that every other single drug of abuse does. It doesn't do it as actively. It's a weaker addictive substance than those guys, but nonetheless addictive, and it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. You can't get away from it. Even if you try to get away from it, you can't, because it's in everything. One half of the sugar you're exposed to, you don't even know you're eating.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the author of the new book just out, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. So you mentioned the heartbreak of treating young kids that are obese and how...
That's terrible.
How the social stigmas against them, etc. The difficult lives that they're entering into, mm-hmm. at such a young age. It does, and I know people when they look at overweight kids, they don't look at them with empathy so much as a kind of scorn. You know,
absolutely.
And it's got to be, but isn't there a connection between the fact that so many of these children, their families just simply don't have a lot of money, and that the way our corporate food industries operate is that the cheaper, the more fat and sugar and salt laden the food is, the more it gives the impression of nutrition, and that way the homemaker, usually quite often a single mother, can spread it out further, can spread the food budget.
Absolutely. This is a war between your wallet and your health. No question about it. One of the reasons processed food has become so prevalent in our society is, number one, it cooks up faster, and time is a major issue, especially with two-parent working families or single, you know, parent families. And number two, you know, there's, I guess, a short-term savings involved, you know, because processed food can, not always, but can be cheaper, certainly not cheaper at the fast food restaurant when you actually total it up, but it can be cheaper, at least in the short run, at home. So ultimately, this is a war between your wallet and your time versus your health, and the question is, which is going to win out? I know where I come down, but you know, this is a decision that society needs to make together, because the one thing that's not okay, the one thing that's not right, is for government to subsidize the food and then ultimately subsidize the emergency room visits that come from the food. That's the one thing that can't happen. You can't have it both ways.
But are you saying, Dr. Robert Lustig, that in effect the government is subsidizing the bad food to make it cheap and available and ubiquitous, as opposed to subsidizing the good food, which people can't afford?
That's exactly right. There's no reason that the government should subsidize bad food. I know why they subsidized corn and soy. It made sense back in the 1930s during the Dust Bowl, when we had a hungry population and we needed storable food that could be shipped around the entire country. The bottom line is that reason is now gone. We could subsidize real food. We could subsidize broccoli. We could subsidize fruits. We could subsidize virtually almost anything we wanted to subsidize in order to try to improve the health of the country. But we don't. And the reason we don't is because there's money to be made.
And you seem, it feels like you're fighting a pretty lonely battle, I must say.
Not so lonely. There are a lot of people on this on our side. You know, the bottom line is people recognize that it's if we don't do something about this now, Medicare will be broke by the year 2024. And that's going to be a whole lot worse. We need to deal with this now, and there are plenty of forward-thinking people who want to get ahead of this. You know, kicking the can down the road is how government handles everything, as we've just seen with the, you know, fiscal cliff and the sequester and everything else. We can kick this can down the road, too, but then we won't have Medicare. And you know what? I'm going to be 67 in 2024, and I want my Medicare.
Well, we can see, though, that how the food industry fight back. I mean, there was a modest proposal from Mayor Bloomberg in New York against the sale of, I think, a minor tax on sugary drinks.
Yep. What he tried to, what he did was he got rid of the Big Gulp. So the Big Gulp ban is in effect at the moment. Right. And I am totally for that. Now, will that fix obesity? No, of course not. But it's a baby step. It's a step in the right direction. It recognizes that government plays a role in public health and needs to do something in order to actually assist the population when they are not able to assist themselves. Ultimately, this is a fight that has to be brought to the food industry. And individuals, you know, are not powerful enough to do it. But cities, governments, states, they are.
But my sense is, though, that we've been distracted and we're going down these kind of cul-de-sacs that aren't solving the problem. Like, for example, one of the popular shows on television is, The Biggest Loser, where literally torture a bunch of people to lose weight.
It's a blood sport, isn't it?
and all of this self-help stuff and all of these endless books that are written about diet, and all of them seem to be missing the point that it's not the person who's overweight who's the problem. It's what they ingest that's the problem.
Well, indeed. Well, here's I can sort of sum this issue up in one basic concept. There's a dogma out there that has to be broken, and that dogma goes like this: a calorie is a calorie. Now, if you believe a calorie is a calorie, and there are reasons why people believe that, you know, from the laws of physics, I mean, the first law of thermodynamics, energy can be neither be created nor destroyed, just shifted around. So the standard mantra is, if you eat it, you better burn it or you're going to store it. In other words, you can get your calories from carrots or you can get them from cheesecake. Ultimately, if you eat more than you burn, you're going to gain weight. If you believe that, all is lost, because then the food industry is not culpable. If you believe that, then it's all about diet and exercise, except for one little problem. Diet and exercise don't work. We've been trying it now for 20 years, and it don't work. There is not one study that shows that exercise causes weight loss. Not one. There are plenty of studies that show diet causes weight loss acutely over 6 months, and then everyone gains it back. The number of recidivists approaches 99.5%. Almost no one can keep their weight off, and there are biochemical reasons why, and I actually address all of these in the book. But if you believe that a calorie is not a calorie, if you believe that the quality of those calories, because they're metabolized different, might have different fates in the body, and that certain calories might actually drive weight gain and those chronic metabolic conditions, then the goal is to get rid of those. Now, I'm not the only one who believes that. There are plenty of people who believe that. Gary Taubes wrote a whole book called Good Calories, Bad Calories around this notion. The point is, you are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. And a calorie is not a calorie. And there are certain calories that are particularly egregious. And of those that are egregious, sugar is the big kahuna. And it's the one that has pervaded our entire life, and it is the one that we have to do something about.
And it's almost incomprehensible to think that that the big food companies know this and that they've used things like low fat and all, you know, they went after fat in the 1970s, but it feels like they just replaced fat with sugar.
That's exactly what they did, because if you take the fat out of the food tastes like cardboard. It tastes terrible. The flavor was in the fat. You know, as an example, try milk. You know, whole milk. You know, I grew up on whole milk. I mean, a lot of people in this country grew up on whole milk. You know what? We drank it. We drank it at school, and no one complained. And then we took the fat out of the milk because everybody went, quote, low fat. The fat was bad. And then all of a sudden the milk tasted like, you know, dishwater. And so what did they have to do? They had to add chocolate. So now we have chocolate milk. So the question I put to you, Ian, is which was worse for you, the fat or the sugar?
Well, that's the choice that's killing us, right?
I mean, well, that is the choice that's killing us, and we need to redo that. I will tell you right now, without question, mark my words, the fat hypothesis has been debunked. Now what we need to do is we need to reassess our diet in a meaningful way. But you know what? We haven't done it. The USDA hasn't done it. The Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee hasn't done it. You know, and there's reasons. It's called politics. It's called money. You know, there's a lot riding on this. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars riding on this via the Farm Bill, via food subsidies, via the SNAP program, and ultimately, you know, through the food industry. This is the battle royal of the 21st century, and we got to win it.
Well, Dr. Robert Lustig, I thank you so much for your book because that is the ammunition that we need in the fight.
Oh, yeah.
And I appreciate your joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, who's a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the past 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at the University of California, San Francisco, Benioff Children's Hospital. He's a member of the UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book just out is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the increasing backlog of judicial nominees from the Obama administration who are being routinely filibustered by Republican senators.